My castaway this week is a music writer and critic. Now 80, he lives in a large house in North London, surrounded by memories of the great names of 20th century music. Poulenc peed against a tree in the front garden. Messiaen is a signatory to the visitor's book. And so the story goes, Nigel Kennedy was conceived in the front room. The man at the centre of these musical connections worked for Sir Thomas Beecham and the Sunday Times, where he was a music critic for more than 40 years. His work, his knowledge and the range of people he's known and encouraged make him one of this country's musical institutions. He is Felix Aprahamian. A lifetime, Felix, devoted to music and to musicians and to this house in Muswell Hill, where you've lived practically all your life since the age of four. Presumably you could never leave it because it's so full of these musical memories.
Well, for a purely practical reason, I couldn't leave it because it's absolutely full of books, music, things I've needed. I've always had my working tools there, you see. No, I'm very happy with it. But
describe it to me. I get the impression it's almost a museum. There are so many musical treasures in it.
It's not a museum, really. Things are locked in bookcases and cupboards, but it doesn't look so unfriendly. It is really lived in.
But you've got a huge and rather special organ in the front room, I think.
No,
the
organ is the chamber organ that my friend André Marchal, the blind organist, had at his country villa in Andai Plage. When André Marchal died, left the villa to his housekeeper, she didn't want the organ. She wanted a piano because she had grandchildren who played the piano. So wouldn't it be nice if Felix would accept this organ? And so it happened.
And what about this tree that was watered by Poulenc? Is it true?
It's a plane tree in the outside. One day, a friend of mine who had gone to Evensong at Westminster Abbey came rushing in. There was a party on. He said, there's a tall man peeing against the plane tree outside. I looked out and I saw it was Poulenc. He thought it would be a waste of time to go up to the first floor or to the gardener's do.
So did he make a habit of it?
Well, certainly not. I doubt if he'd have done that in the Rue de Médicis where he lived in Paris, but I suppose
in Muswell Hill it was okay.
In Muswell it was all right.
What year would that have been then?
Well, I suppose it would be 45... 46, immediately after the official end of the war, or maybe even after the liberation of Paris, which was before the end of the war.
And is it true somebody tried to chop this tree down at some point and you said, no, you can't possibly do that? This is a historic monument.
Absolutely. It's my private reason to speak eloquently, perhaps, in the town hall that that row of plane trees should be preserved. I think it deserves a little brass plaque.
I want to talk to you a lot about your music, obviously, but let's have some music to start with. Tell me about your first Desert Island disc.
Well, boy and man, I've been very much bound up with the music of Frederick Delius. And my first memory of a Delius piece was going home late one night in 1929, and my mother called me and said, you must listen to this music I've been listening to on headphones, you know, crystal set. And just by chance, I chanced on the final pages of Delius's Mass of Life being conducted by Sir Thomas Beecham in April 1929 at the last concert of the Delius Festival, which he organised in London. And that was my first experience of Delius.
Yeah.
the end of Delius' massive life with the London Philharmonic Choir and the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Sir Thomas Beecham. So Felix Abrahamian, the critic, is a living encyclopedia of memories of 20th century musicians, but you might have been one yourself, I understand. You were a bit of a prodigy on the piano, is that right?
Oh, never. Never. I mean, that's... Well, you know how bad you are.
But you performed.
Oh, no, it's a children's piece you learn from the piano teacher around the corner, and you are busking one day in the ship's lounge, and somebody hears and says, we must play at the ship's concert, and you do, and you play a dreadful sixpenny piano transcription of Ache d'Amore from the Trovatore without knowing it has a middle section. And you play it, and a flautist adds the middle section. You don't know there is a middle section, and you just curl up. And then when he comes in with the tune again, you join in. I mean, this was awful. It was the beginning of critical wisdom to know how bad you are.
This was en route to New York.
Yeah, we were visiting our grandparents in 1923.
So you decided then and there that performance was not for you, did you?
Oh, well, I suppose they were so embarrassed. I mean, I have played with people in the decent privacy of one's music room.
But your parents knew nothing about music?
Well, my mother adored it. Indeed, it was she who got me to listen to the last bars of the Mass of Life on that memorable occasion. But to my father, he could never conceive that music means a lot more than being a brilliant performer yourself.
So where do you get it from, then? Your ear for music you get from your mother, you're saying?
I think so, yes.
But is there
my
any
father
more?
My father liked Chansonnière in his Paris years, but I think my love of music, my compulsive life of music, really is a harmonic thing. In other words, the instant, spontaneous, emotional appeal of music, and I think that's a harmonic thing.
Let's have record number two.
Well, once I awoke to music, probably in my last year at school, that was probably the cause of my failing matric, because I became addicted to music. I was taken to my first prom in 1930. From that time onwards, I was a season ticket holder of the proms, 30 bob a time, stood 50 nights out of 51, shall we say, and that went on, by and large, till 39. Then, of course, in those days, Bax was a popular figure at concerts at the proms. And we heard the symphonies as they came out one by one, and Sir Henry was devoted to Bax's music. And he was a sort of demigod for me in those days. And when I first heard his Tintagel, I decided I would go and see what Tintagel was like and sent him a card from Tintagel. And the record I knew in those days was, in fact, conducted by Eugène Goossens, whom I got to know in the 30s, and his new symphony orchestra.
Part of Arnold Bax's Tintagel, played by the new symphony orchestra conducted by Eugène Goossens. That would have been very modern music for you, Felix, written when you were perhaps about 4 years old, I think, and you were appreciating it, you say, in your teens, and then the Delius you had first would have been written about 10 years earlier. So, as a young man, you obviously had very avant-garde taste.
Not really. Romantic musical taste, neo-romantic taste. I mean, this is long before I'd heard probably a Beethoven symphony. I may have heard it in the background, was aware of it, but I liked the 20th century English repertory and ditto French. repertory.
But you also, of course, in your teens, managed to meet some of these people who were writing. You once spent an afternoon with Delius, didn't you?
Yes, but I mean, that again was, it was an addictive thing. I realised I hadn't had a real musical education, you know, I hadn't been through the mill. And where would I learn music from? But through contact with the people who made it. It wasn't just a question of being an autograph hunter. The three of us were inseparable. There was Ernest Chapman, who worked at Boosey & Hawkes, Delius's publishers, and Donald Pitt, who was at the Royal College of Music. He just graduated from Oxford. We used to go to contemporary music concerts together. Ernest had parents who lived at Saint-Cloud, and the idea was we should go to Paris for the weekend. We went to Saint-Cloud, and on the Sunday we did the Paris churches, and on the Monday, by appointment, we visited Delius at Grecy-en-Roi.
What sort of an experience was it?
Well, I suppose it was really very wonderful. Everything centred around Mrs. Delius. She was not at all like the Mrs. Delius portrayed in Ken Russell's film. Delius was old, tired, ill, but, my God, he missed nothing. He missed absolutely nothing. I remember we were asked whether we'd take tea or wine. Well, of course, it would be wine. It came from London. And immediately he would order a bottle of Perrier water to be cooled and wine to be cooled. And when it finally came, Mrs. Delius got some crystal glasses out of the dresser, and you hear Delius's voice saying, "No, not those glasses, dear, the green glasses." So he missed absolutely nothing.
And did you play music?
No, not at all. I nearly killed him with questions. I wanted to know a lot about things. That was all very useful.
And you'd spent the previous day, if I'm not mistaken, as well as doing the Paris churches, with Vidor.
Yes, I had a card of introduction to Vidor, but he wasn't at Notre Dame. So we quickly went to Saint-Sulpice, where, using a card addressed Cher Maître to Vienne, I waved it in front of the sacristan and got admitted to the organ loft of Vidor, who promptly asked me to sit on the bench beside him. That was the best organ lesson I ever had, because he happened to be playing a piece that I'd actually been practising.
Not the toccata?
No, not the toccata. An easy piece, the adagio from his Suite Latine. But it was terrific because he played it exactly as it was printed. It was a very valuable lesson.
And you were 19 years old?
I was 19.
How old would he have been?
He was 89. There was 70 years difference between us. But of course, you know, when he was 19, he knew Rossini. In fact, he took part in a performance of the Petite Messe Solennelle. And when Rossini was 19, he probably knew Beethoven. So you see the apostolic succession, the laying on of hands, comes through from Beethoven to Charles-Marie Vidor and then to Apprehension.
Let's have record number three.
Well, I went to as many concerts as I could. I remember in 1932, the BBC Symphony Concerts at Queen's Hall, and one of the items of Sir Henry Wood's symphony concert included Maggie Tate singing Ravel's song cycle, Scheherazade.
Maggie Tate singing L'Indifférent from Ravel's Scheherazade. So you started, Felix Apprehension, soaking up all this music and musicians, and even at the age of 17, I think you were writing about it for small publications. But your father wanted you to go into business, didn't he? He didn't want you to do with this music stuff.
Oh, no, I mean, he he thought it would be a sure way of starving. And it's a great regret I have that I was never able to explain to him there were people in the music industry who sold music, printed music, wrapped up parcels, conducted, played flute in an orchestra. I mean, there was a whole spectrum of incredible life-enhancing jobs that you could do within the sphere of music.
What job did he do, your father?
He was Armenian, of course, and a naturalised British subject at the turn of the century. He was much older than I was, and he was in the carpet business.
What did he think you should do?
Oh, he thought that I should get a job in a respectable Fenchurch Street broker's office that were on the commercial sale rooms and on the metal exchange. I joined an eminent firm as an office boy.
But you were bored with the metal exchange generally?
Well, I mean, yes, I mean, it was not a... But my real life began when I got the tube from Bank to Oxford Circus and came to life in the concert room.
So you turned your back on a healthy income in the metal business and you took a job with the London Philharmonic.
It wasn't a healthy income.
Wasn't it?
Oh, no. It was...
Well, it might have
19
been.
19 shillings a week when I started in 1931 and went up to 30 shillings a week. And then I decided I shall just starve. And then I knew Thomas Russell, a viola player in the London Philharmonic Orchestra. We used to share a pair of press seats occasionally, you know, the pseudo-press, when the critic wasn't eminent enough to get a whole pair of seats. Sometimes, if a house had to be papered, a pair of press seats would be divided, and I found myself sitting next to Thomas Russell. And it was my friend Ernest Chapman, the one who was instrumental in my going to visit Delius, told Tom that I was wanting a job and it had to be in music. So I was sent for, and I began working for the London Philharmonic Orchestra on January the 1st, 1940, the phony period of the war, voluntarily restricting my salary to £3.10 a week, which is what the air raid wardens got.
Tell me about record number four.
Yes, well, in the 30s, my experience of music was mostly orchestral and chamber, recitals, etc. No opera. I'm not really an opera buff. But I think possibly on a desert island I should have at least one operatic excerpt. And, of course, there's no question in my mind that it would be the one opera that I would not be without, Pelléas et Mélisande of Debussy.
Jacques Janssen and Irène Joachim singing the duet Je l'ai nous from Debussy's Pelléas et Mélisande. You started work for the Sunday Times, Felix, in 1948, and you stayed for 41 years.
41 years.
Did you have your own rules that you wrote by when writing music criticism? After all, any artistic criticism is a subjective business. How did you make sure that yours was reasonably objective and interesting?
Well, I mean, I have that problem all the time. The one's reaction to the music I heard was instantly, immediately subjective, if you wish. But if you have a performer, for example, or even a new work, then you have to say, well, how many out of 10 would I give that for melody? How many out of 10 would I give that for harmony? How many out of 10 for rhythm? How many out of 10 for colour, orchestration? somehow or other you can build up your instinctive percentage.
But how hard should we, the ordinary listener, have to work at enjoying a piece of music? Because we're frequently told these days, particularly where modern music is concerned, that, you know, it is our shortcoming if we don't like it, if we haven't got there to, you know, far enough to appreciate it.
With respect, I think that's rubbish. Your instinctive reaction to a piece of music must be emotional and subjective. To get to know a lot more about it will help. The more you know about a piece of music, it won't spoil its enjoyment of that piece of music. But that's a secondary thing. I mean, you see, the music appeals to the heart, first of all. Then it appeals to the head, the intellectual content of it, and to the feet. There must be a dance element in it. And perhaps for something that lies between the feet and the heart, the sex. Now, for example, after Delius, I could come right out and say that my favourite composer is Bach. There is a man who appeals to the head, the heart and the feet. No sex in the music. But obviously it's going to help you appreciate Bach if you know how it's all put together. But the instant appeal must be emotional, first of all.
Next piece of music. Talking about emotion.
Well, let me indulge myself further in this sort of morass of neo-romantic, self-indulgent music. Recording today, this is what I feel. It is quite possible that in a fortnight's time, although three or four of those discs would remain permanently, there are others which I'm perhaps even besotted with for a short period. This happened to me quite recently. It was Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony. I knew it. I had many recordings of it. Now, I suppose in the last fortnight I must have heard this a dozen times. If you were to remove me to a desert island tomorrow, I'd insist on taking that record with me. But don't write me down as a musical degenerate, because it happens to me my desert island disc choice today.
Part of Rachmaninoff's Symphony No. 2 in E minor, played by the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by Edward Downes. Is there a modern-day composer, a contemporary composer, who moves you at all, Felix?
Oh, yes, plenty. The question is whether I would take them to the desert island with me.
But do you enjoy the music of Harry Birtwistle and Peter Maxwell Davis? Doesn't sound as if it's your kind of music.
No. One or two of Max's pieces, very late, that I enjoy.
But if I can quote you to yourself, you said that after the war, composers all started wearing the same drab raincoats and became boring. What do you mean by that, and why do you think that?
Well, I mean, the post-war composers wrote, if you wish, atonal or 12-tone music. You couldn't identify the composers, whereas the composers of the school that I'm interested in, the school, the golden age, as it were, whether it's English music or French music, which is really the first 50 years of this our own century, they wore not only their nationality, but their musical heart on their sleeve, and they were instantly identifiable.
But those people who like contemporary music, like Birtwistle and Maxwell Davis, would say that you're simply old-fashioned, that you're anti-avant-garde. What do you
say? No, I'm not anti-avant-garde. I go a second time to hear them. I stick my neck out. I have no Hanslick.
So you work quite hard at them?
Well, no, I went to hear Max's St. Michael's Sonata, the Cheltenham Sonata, commissioned by Cheltenham, And I thought it was... I didn't care for it very much at the time, and I said so. 25 years later, it was repeated at the Cheltenham Festival as one of their early commissions. And I thought, now, Felix, this is your opportunity to go and show that you have learnt something. Do you know, it sounded even worse the second performance 25 years after than it did previously. So I'm not rushing on the bandwagon.
Well, that's the point, really. Is that your shortcoming or is that the shortcoming of the music?
Well, I won't be so boastful to say it's shortcoming of the music. I mean, I'll take bets that quite a number of these music... I mean, of course, there'll be individual pieces which will be played. There are pieces of Schoenberg which will be played.
But you don't think that the bulk of it will last in the way that the music of Rachmaninoff or Tchaikovsky will last?
Frankly, no.
Record number 6.
At the time I discovered music, I also discovered the possibility of the organ as a musical instrument. And, of course, absolute god for father of music is Johann Sebastian Bach. My love of organ music brought me into contact, as I've said, with André Marchal, whose organ I've inherited at Muswell Hill. And he has recorded the little organ book, the Orgelbüchlein of Bach. And here's a simple page, the choral prelude, Chris der Einge Gottessohn, and recorded by Marchal on one of his favourite instruments, that in the Grossmünster at Zurich.
That was Bach's choral prelude, Christ der Einige Gottessohn, played by André Marchal. There's no popular music in these choices, Felix, but you apparently have a soft spot for Gershwin and for Shearing, is that right?
Oh, yes, but not for sound pollution.
What sound pollution?
Well, you know.
Pop music?
Yeah, of course.
Any pop music? All
no,
pop music?
I mean, I for my personal pleasure, I play records by George Shearing, Stefan Grappelli.
But you don't think modern popular music has anything to commend it at all?
Not to me, no. I stopped with the Beatles or pre-Beatles.
But there are people and quite serious music critics who would acknowledge that the Beatles, you know, will go down in history as a great landmark, a great turning point in the history of Western popular music.
I mean, there's been popular music and popular music. I think it'll... And I don't want to sound snobbish about this at all, but it doesn't get me.
But do you think the Beatles are overrated?
Probably not at the time. For example, take a work of Benjamin Britten. Everybody went mad about the War Requiem. It's a marvellous work. Whereas another work with the same sentiments by Delius failed in the 20s. Now, it may be that in 200 years' time, there will be more performances of Delius's Requiem than of Britten's War Requiem. These are tracts for the times, and they may be fashionable tracts for a certain time. But I'm not going to put my neck out and say, yes, it's like this today and it will always be so.
But it's interesting that your musical choice is practically, I think, all of it except for the notable exception of Bach, the other seven are all from the first 30 years of this century.
That's when I came to life. So in that sense, I do reflect my age, not necessarily my parents' age, my own age. I grew up when Bax was writing his music. Ravel was alive. Debussy was recently... Well, he was alive when I was alive. And Poulenc, too. We have a song by Poulenc. He was one of those artists who, with Bernac, was just known in London before the war, but the platform at the Wigmore Hall was the useful way of their returning to their London audience. And at his first concert with Bernac, post-war concert, he sang this extraordinarily moving song, C'est, words by Louis Aragon. And there was hardly a dry eye in the house when this was sung at Wigmore Hall after the war years.
Pierre Bernac singing C, composed and accompanied by Francis Poulenc. What do you do in Muswell Hill these days, Felix? Are the musical people and the comings and goings as numerous as ever?
I work. I do Steve Notes. I prepare BBC scripts when I'm asked to do so. I read quite a bit one way or another.
I read a story of your unearthing not long ago a Bartok score, which had been amended by the composer himself. I wonder how much you worry that you have more hidden treasures buried among your papers that only you can identify.
Oh, I'm cataloguing gradually. I mean, long before writing the autobiography, for which I've had a contract for the last 15 years, I'm too busy living my daily life instead of worrying about setting it down. The stuff I've got in the house, I'm more concerned that it goes to the right place.
Which is?
Well, I'm making my mind up. You must never give it away.
What about you on your desert island? What are you going to do? I mean, there's no piano, there's no music, only your wind-up gramophone and these 8 records.
Well, I probably read. I'm allowed, what do you say, the Shakespeare, the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And one other book,
mm-hmm.
Well, Proust, A la recherche du temps perdu. It takes a long time to read through. You don't have to read anything else, really.
So you'll read and you'll listen to your music and you'll be entirely happy, will you?
I don't know. I think I would be quite happy. It would be time to not have to listen to music I didn't want to listen to or to read things I didn't want to read. I mean, that goes for present-day papers. For years, I was down to only 2 periodicals, Private Eye and World of the Interior. Now I don't even take those. Cuttings are brought to me every day. Sometimes 2 or 3 of the same cutting. People know what I will collect.
Tell me about your last record.
My last record? Well, I was going to suggest the last record should be the opening of Dionysus' Mass of Life. I began my musical career, as it were, with listening to Beecham at that incredible Delius Festival he organised in 1929 and a recording he made in the 30s. But recently, a record has come out, a CD, with Norm Del Mar conducting. I was present at this performance and I was sitting next to Eric Fembe, Dionysus' amanuensis. And immediately the first movement was over, we turned round to each other and spontaneously we said, "The best since Beecham."
The opening of Delius' Massive Life with the BBC Chorus and Symphony Orchestra conducted by Norman Del Mar. Well, now, if you could only take one of those eight records, Felix.
Oh, I think it would be the Bach. Something absolutely pure and absolute music and something one could never tire of.
And what about your luxury?
Well, I carry that with me, a Swiss Army knife, with all the various prongs. You know, I could trim my nails, trim my beard, I could peel fruit. Not for any design of escaping or building a raft or anything, but simply as a rather civilized thing to have with me.
Felix Abrahamian, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.